Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So I was in the shower, I was cleaning my ass and making all the shirts all sparkly, spanking clean.
I'm not the funny one, I'm the pretty one.
Cock shots. I just checked myself out.
Music, wine, and then loop up and get on top.
The glory hole's like a dick theater. I've imagined your pants.
Which means your pants had better come off. Mama needs playtime.
We're not sluts.
We just love love.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome back to another By the By.
Hello.
How y'all doing out there in podcast land?
Good.
All of our microphone people?
Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, I'm Bradford.
I'm Angela.
And you're back here with us.
Yeah.
Upcoming events. We have on June 30th, the next Pendulum Party. It is pride themed. So that's the kind of wear your pride, bright colors, whatever you feel like it's going to be.
Whatever you're proud of.
Yeah.
Show it off.
It's going to be a bash where you can be unabashed.
Ha. Ha.
Huzzah. Then we have way in November. Uh-huh. Well, actually, no, we have in July, mid-July.
You keep skipping it.
I don't know why.
I'm so looking forward to this.
Yes. July 15th, we are going to be at Between Friends Wine Bar.
In Melbourne.
So we're going to be doing a live podcast from there. So come, bring your stories, sit down and chat with us for a bit. And yeah, we'll be talking about some of our fun experiences.
Yeah.
What else?
And then we're going to be having some fun experiences.
That's right. Because, I mean, we are staying. We'll pack up our stuff and stay for the evening.
Yeah. Very much looking forward to that. And also, you know, Melbourne. It's fun.
I love Melbourne. Yay. Yeah. Then in November 8th through the 13th, we have Escape to the Tropics. Very much looking forward to that. Mm-hmm. It is our resort takeover that we do with our dear friends over at Exclusively RHP. We do have still a couple more rooms remaining, but there's been some interest and, you know.
We have our themes set.
We do have our themes set.
So that's exciting. So we can start working on costumes, which I have not even begun to think about yet.
I've started thinking about, started collecting things, so we'll see. In an upcoming podcast, we'll get Ray and Jackie back on.
Yeah.
We'll talk about what we're doing, what it's going to be like, and what to expect.
Yeah, that'll be great.
Yeah. So, what are we talking about tonight?
We're just going to jump right into it, eh?
I mean, what else is there?
All right. So, tonight we are talking about queer coding.
Ooh.
So, queer coding, for those who don't know, is subtly displaying a character as queer. So you'll see this a lot in media, TV, movies, and it's often not certain what the sexual identity is of the character, whether they're queer or not, but a character might be shown or coded, hence queer coding, as queer through the use of traits and stereotypes like clothing, behaviors, that type of thing. So maybe exaggerated masculinity, femininity, vanity, hypersexuality. It really is like all those things that you think of as stereotypical, that's what you'll see. And so it's a way that characters can be portrayed as queer without actually saying that they're queer. And in some cases, they may be intended to be, and in some cases may not be.
Yeah. And it's in many cases, almost a caricature of what the norms, the heteros out there would have expected queer people to have portrayed.
Yeah.
So it is kind of like queer actions, but to the nth degree. And we've talked about this some when, if you go back and listen to our podcasts on films such as like the Professor Marston and the Wonder Women. I know a couple of years ago, maybe even last year, we did a whole episode on horror movies. Mm. There's a lot of queer coding in both of those films. So it's just, that's kind of a gist.
Yeah. And it's thought that queer coding comes from the strict regulations of how queer characters were able to be portrayed in early filmmaking. So in 1930, and we've talked about this before in the past as well, in 1930, the Hays Code came into effect, which was the predecessor to the MPAA now. And so the Hays Code was a standard for what was allowed to be shown in movies. And so, like, films were not allowed to portray perverse subjects such as homosexuality and a whole list of other things. Look it up if you're not familiar with it.
Sexual deviancy, I think, was the word that they used.
Yeah, go down the YouTube rabbit hole on the Hays Code. It's disturbing and depressing. But because films couldn't show, like, perverse subjects like homosexuality, sexual deviancy, that type of thing, it led to this portrayal of non-explicitly queer characters. And so filmmakers and writers were trying to find ways to kind of subvert it and get the message in without actually having to say that this character is queer. So subtly portraying characters as queer in these ways didn't breach the code. And that's kind of turned into these, like Bradford was saying, these modern portrayals of queer characters, which are a bit over the top and to the nth degree. It's really pretty interesting when you look at like where it comes from. And just as a side note, there is a documentary called The Celluloid Closet that was made in 95 or 96, I think 95. Yeah. And we actually just recently watched it. And this was one of the first instances in which the idea of queer coding was presented to the public. And it's actually really fascinating to watch and to look at how some of these writers and filmmakers tried to get around it and put the message in subtly as opposed to just overtly.
Yeah, it's based off of a book, Vito Russo, from about 1981 or so, that was just an exploration of queer characters and queerness in films.
Yeah, yeah. And so Bradford has quite an extensive list, I think, of examples of queer coding in media. So we'll let you take it from here and run us through.
So one thing that you find when you're digging into queer coding in films is that many of them are villains, and at least many of them, many of the people who are queer coded, especially in the looking at it from the 80s, 90s, they're the bad guys,
which
right?
doesn't really do much to dispel the thoughts that homosexuality is bad.
Yeah, it's interesting because like I see it both ways. I see it both ways in that at least this is representation showing that these people exist and that they're real. Yeah, they're all villains and that really sucks. But, you know, and I think that to get to where we are now, where we're seeing more positive portrayals of queerness in film and in other media, that we had to do the villain thing first. Mm-hmm. And it's because now the non-queer people are seeing this and going, oh yeah, these people exist. These people are real. And then once you get used to them or once they get used to them, then it's easier to show them in a more positive light.
That's fair. So what are some examples of villains?
All right. So let's start with, Disney, because Disney has, Disney portrayed a large number of our classic animated series films, you know. Many of the villains have queer coding. So starting from the top, Ursula from The Little Mermaid. So Ursula, when you watch her, she's actually was originally sort of based upon the drag queen Divine. So Ursula's mannerisms, speech patterns, exaggerated makeup, all of these are associated with drag culture. And so she
can totally see that.
Yeah. And she's the bad guy. She's the sea witch and she looks like a drag queen.
Mm, yeah. I can absolutely 100% see that.
Then we have Scar from The Lion King. So again, he very flamboyant in his mannerisms, his cultured accent that was often associated with gay stereotypes, very well spoken. You must be gay kind of thing.
Okay.
Because, you know, straight folk don't talk like that, you know, or they talk like this, I guess. But he also has a very close platonic relationship with the hyenas. So they kind of show this queer family dynamic of all of them live together kind of thing. They all work together and, you know, they're all clearly, not, you know, he's not looking for, I guess he does try to seduce Nala, but it's not, he doesn't try very hard. He keeps the bird in a cage. Come on. Next up would be Jafar from Aladdin.
Okay.
Again, similar to Scar. So he's kind of more effeminately depicted than any of the other characters in the film. I mean, his eyes alone are I think he's, I got guy liner on, right? Mm. And so, and he's more cultured than the other male characters. So he's sly, he's cunning, the way he speaks and the way he carries himself, all things that are seen as characteristics of queer culture.
Yeah.
Again,
that
from femininity. Through a straight lens. Right. Yeah.
Femininity of a male character.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And then we've got Hades from Hercules. So Hades, again, depicted very flamboyantly, very sarcastic mannerisms, similar to the stereotype of the dramatic gay man, or if you go back in time, the poof.
Okay.
The prissy gay man kind of thing.
I need a moment to remember Hades because it's been a while since I've seen Hercules, but yeah, I got it.
He's an outcast living in the underworld apart from all the other gods. Oh, gee, I wonder why. Yeah. Maybe if you weren't gay, you wouldn't be down there in hell.
Yeah.
Which can parallel the feelings of being ostracized for being queer.
Yeah.
So it's interesting because one of the things, well, I guess I got one more from Disney's lexicon, which is LeFou from Beauty and the Beast. He's Gaston's sidekick, but he has such an intense admiration for Gaston that it could be interpreted as a crush. He's got effeminate mannerisms, very submissive to Gaston. He's clearly Gaston's bottom. Mm-mm. And that further, you know, contributes to the fact that he's queer.
Yeah.
And one of the things I look at this is this to me was, yeah, they're all villains, but this was a point where things were maybe transitioning, right? So like they're all very likable villains. Ursula's got one of the best songs in the show. Scar as well has a couple of great lines and good songs. Jafar is, he's got the best sidekick. But like, you know.
But they're not like villains that you're like, oh, I really don't like them.
Yeah, they're villains that you want to sort of root for. Yeah. You want them to succeed.
You at least want to see what they're going to be doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hades is hilarious in Hercules. And then LeFou is just this kind of a likable oaf.
Yeah.
And I do see how that is, all of these are sort of negatively stereotyping queerness, but at the same time, it's showing none of them are really harmful. They all are trying. I mean, Ursula's big thing is she got a voice and she just wanted to have, you know, she wanted to get revenge on her brother.
Yeah.
Family strife, right. Normal stuff.
Yeah.
You know, Jafar wants to be the king of the world, but he's bumbling and can't get it done. Mm-hmm. So none of them are really like, their plans are good plans, but none of them succeed at doing it. So I don't see them as being harmful.
They're not big threats.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think that it makes the coding a little, like, it is someone that you could look at and go, oh yeah, I can see. Mm. Yeah. There's a little LeFou in me.
You wish.
No one fucks like Gaston. So some other along that, this, you know, similar line is the Jim Carrey's portrayal of the Riddler in Batman, Batman Forever, I guess. Again, very flamboyant with his mannerisms, wild costumes, really many of the Batman. There was a lot of queer coding in Batman, period. Mm. The relationship that Batman and Robin have with one another. It at times is portrayed as a father son sort of relationship. But with their age, it seems a lot more like they're, you know, a little more than BFFs. But, you know, the Riddler, a lot of what his mannerisms and whatnot were sort of thought of as what gay men would do.
Yeah.
Norman Bates from Psycho has often been read as a queer-coded character due to his cross-dressing and his close, complicated relationship with his mother. And then he's depicted as having a split personality, one of them being his mother, which ties to the movie's queer subtext that he is both male and female at the same time. And it's this interesting sort of representation of gender. So, yeah, that's...
So if I can interject here for a moment.
Please.
Talking about the cross-dressing in that film. So one of the things that the Celluloid Closet brought up was talking about how, you know, men in women's clothing in films was often seen as funny.
And still is.
And so people would laugh at it and it was lighthearted. And then you put a woman in men's clothing and it was much more serious. You know, it didn't have that lightheartedness that men in women's clothing has.
And I think that sort of goes back to, and I'm saying this not as this is what I believe, but this is the way I think people perceive, is a woman dressing in men's clothing is an attack on power. You know, she wants power. Whereas a man dressing in a woman's clothing is taking a power and sort of ridiculing it and showing it as weak. Because we can laugh at that. It's funny to see.
It's more frivolous.
Playful, but mm-hmm. it shouldn't be, right? Mm-hmm. So you can't take either seriously. Laws, no.
Yeah.
But if you're a man dressing as a woman, you're giving up your power.
Yeah.
And then if you're a woman dressing as a man, you're trying to take power. So I think that's that. There's a really minute difference there, but I think it's really important, and that's why we laugh at one and don't at the other.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
So some other examples that I found. Peppermint Patty from the Peanuts.
Character.
She is often considered as a queer-coded character because she's a tomboy who excels at sports, has short hair,
mm-hmm.
and often wears what is typically considered masculine clothing. Mm-hmm. Has a close relationship with Marcy, which some interpret as having queer undertones.
Mm-hmm. And I think that is interesting as well, that relationship, because what you do see in a lot of films is these close relationships between people of the same gender. And so it could be interpreted as a close friendship, or it could be interpreted as something more.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that depends upon the lens you're looking at it through and exactly what they're saying, their mannerisms, tones, that kind of thing. And I think kind of just, you know, how you interpret it might be different than how I interpret it, but it's very clear that the writers, the directors, that the actors, that they all help put a spin on it as well.
Yeah. And it is something, you're right. It is, we all are looking for something different, right? When we, mm-hmm. when we see films. And I think that it's something that has always surprised me about people in general, but like the uproar over Ariel being black in the new Little Mermaid, or there's been other things like that, that people just go up in arms about. And it's like, of course people want to see themselves. When you look at these films, you want to find a little bit of yourself in there, because part of seeing a film and sort of letting the veil lift and you go into this magical realm is putting yourself in that magical realm. And so if you see somebody who looks like yourself, it's easier to say, oh, cool, this is how I would behave. Mm-hmm. And so it's nice to see, you know, young black children or young queer children being able to see these characters and go, oh yeah, this is how I would react.
Yeah.
I see me up there. And I still, it's one of the things that bothers me, I think, the most about the conservative communities, is that both religious and political, is that they only want people to see them through their own lens. They're trying to control the lens through which we see the world. And if you try to see it through maybe somebody else's lens, you're woke.
Yeah.
Like that's an insult. Wow. You mean if woke is the worst thing that they can be, that I could be called, like that's...
But that also,
lazy.
But that also means that in order to do that, you need either people who are very in touch with the community and part of the community, or those who identify as queer, as black, as whatever it is, that they need to be involved in the writing, the directing, yeah. like the entire creative process, basically, right?
Yeah.
Because otherwise you're not going to get that message across. You're not going to get the tone. People aren't going to see themselves in the same way through it.
Well, and it goes back to, I was watching a YouTube video recently, and one of the comments was on Big Bang Theory. And it was, the problem with the Big Bang Theory, and I know that you love it, I know a lot of people love the show, but the problem with the Big Bang Theory is that's not how nerd fiefdoms actually speak.
Oh, right.
Nerds don't talk like that. That's how a bunch of writers in a room think that nerds talk. And I think that's really important, because it that sort of goes for queer people as well, right?
Yeah.
If you have a bunch of cis white guys in a room writing for a lesbian couple, of course they don't know it. That there's no lived experience, and it doesn't, you know, I don't know if this is fortunate or unfortunate. It's not a one-to-one.
Yeah.
You don't just, if I've had a relationship, I can't just switch out the genders and then suddenly it makes sense. That, 'cause that's not how it is.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah.
It's talking what you were saying before about two people of the same gender running around and doing things. Mm. Xena, warrior princess.
Yeah.
So Xena and Gabrielle are often interpreted as having a romantic relationship due to their close bond and their emotional intimacy. And their creators and actors have even acknowledged the undertones that mm-hmm. were there. Because the when the show was aired, you know, it wasn't something that could be shown explicitly on screen. So it was all, if you were looking for it, you found it.
Yeah.
You didn't. And things like, I'm not going to dive into it right now, but if you're listening at home, Google it. It's great. The Subaru commercials, the ads for Subaru in the U.S. in the, I think, late 90s.
I would have said late 90s. Yeah.
That were clearly queer coded.
Yeah.
Like, read the license plates alone. They are, you know, so that's why in the States, even still, I think it's just now starting to change a bit. If you saw a Subaru, you're like, oh, I bet it's owned by a lesbian couple.
Yep.
And it was. Because like marketing works. They were being directly marketed to, and Subaru succeeded in doing that very well. I've got more, but first, a quick word from me.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
How you doing, mate? Are you tired of taking sticks and trying to turn them into sex toys? Are you becoming a MacGyvo? That's like MacGyver. But I'm both Southern and Australian. That's kind of cool. Anyway, MacGyvo, he is the Australian MacGyver that takes all kinds of random things and turns them into delightful sex toys. They're not delightful, and he doesn't succeed. What he should do is go to adamandeve.com. If you go to adamandeve.com and use checkout code BYTHEBY, that's BYTHEBI, you will get one item at 50% off. You'll also get free shipping. MacGyvo likes free shipping. Then you'll get 6 videos on demand and some extra things thrown into your box. Some little exciting surprises. Go to adamandeve.com. Use checkout code BYTHEBY. BYTHEBI. It's MacGyvo approved. We all know one of our favorite games is Curious Humans game. It's such a great game to sit down and play with your friends, your family, both naked and clothed. Like, I know, not naked with your family, but anyway. Because they even have games like Aussie Humans, where there are questions about, like, how do we feel about certain Australian things? Like the cowboy bill pops. Like, that's, I mean, it took me a while to figure out what that even was. But it's a fun game to play. Their base game is also, you know, pretty PG, and all the cards are color-coded. So you could take out the more risky cards, take out the red deck, and then you could play it with people, you know, your kids even. It's a great game. CuriousHumansGame.com. Use checkout code for 10% off. Checkout code BYTHEBY.
All right. You've got more. What do you have?
Now, so those were kind of the negative ones. Let's look at maybe some of the more positive queer-coded characters.
Okay.
Positive depictions. They're a little harder to find. Firstly, one we're all going to be familiar with is Velma from Scooby-Doo.
I like Velma.
I mean, Velma has long been viewed as a queer-coded character due to her intellectualism. Mm-hmm. She's smart. She must be queer. It cracks me up. Like, because you're right. Only smart people are queer. The only dumb people I ever met were heterosexuals.
Is that true?
No.
Okay. Yeah.
Still kind of funny.
Yeah.
So she also lacks an interest in traditionally feminine pursuits, mm-hmm. and she has a very close relationship with Daphne. interpretation was confirmed in 2020, one of the show's producers, that she is queer.
I liked her.
I do too. Going back to Beauty and the Beast, potentially the relationship between Lumiere and Cogsworth. Both of them bicker the entire film like an old married couple would anyway. Uh-huh. So are they just really close friends? It's a close relationship between two characters that has been read as coded.
I can see that.
Neither one specifically identifies as queer, but it could be read into it. SpongeBob SquarePants. So he's not explicitly queer, but SpongeBob's creator has stated that the character is asexual, which is a queer identity. Mm-hmm. SpongeBob's non-traditional masculine behavior and close relationships with other male characters have also been interpreted as possible queer coding.
Okay.
Willow from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Yes, she did go crazy, but she only went crazy after her, spoiler alert, after her girlfriend was killed. So like...
Also, Dark Willow's pretty hot, too.
Dark Willow's fucking hot. But very great queer character. Not the best with relationships, but, you know, still good queer character.
Not everybody's good with relationships, queer or not, Bradford.
No, I know. I'm just saying. Then if we look at video games, Ellie from The Last of Us.
Oh, yeah.
So Ellie's relationship with her friend Riley in the game and with Dina in the sequel show a strong positive queer representation from the game.
I can see that.
So we're going to bounce around now. So one of the things I wanted to look at too was queer coding in like classic books, which we've hit some of it, but, and some of this will be, well, realistically, mostly negative, but there's some positive. Mm-hmm. So The Picture of Dorian Gray by Oscar Wilde. Oscar Wilde himself was a gay man, and many of his works are imbued with homoeroticism and gay subtext. Mm-hmm. So Dorian Gray's relationship with Basil Hallward, who is the fella who paints the original picture and repeatedly proclaims his love for Dorian, is often interpreted as queer. And so I recently saw a stage production of this, and the way they did it, it was very clear, like, that part of the reason why this painting had this magical spell over it was because Basil put so much of his own love and lust for Dorian into this painting. So it sort of took on his life.
Right.
We've talked about this in the past. Dracula by Bram Stoker.
Yeah.
Very clearly portrayed homoerotic elements between the characters of Jonathan Harker and Dracula at the very beginning. Then Dracula has, you know, his wives, the women who then try to pounce on Harker, and then Mina Harker and Lucy, mm-hmm. their relationship.
Yep. Yep, definitely.
Going back for Hitchcock again, the book is Rebecca, and then Hitchcock adapted it for film. The character of, and this was part of what we watched today, The Celluloid Closet, then the Mrs. Danvers shows mm-hmm. this intense obsessiveness over the lost Rebecca, and it's going so far as to showing her underwear to the young lady. It's yeah
hey,
this is her underwear, look at it, really nice, made by nuns. Ben-Hur, Gore Vidal, one of the screenwriters, stated that he wrote the relationship between Judah Ben-Hur and Missala as a form of romantic relationship, although it was not explicitly stated in the film. But there's a few clips where if you watch when they first meet or re-meet, it's definitely Heston had no idea what was going on. But I don't think Heston ever had any idea what was ever going on. But it's clearly these guys were a couple, and then, you know, now they're back. Mm. And then Spartacus, the relationship between the characters of Crassus and Antonius, mm-hmm. also filled with homoerotic subtext. The famous scene that was, I think it was actually cut, the snails and oysters scene, where he's basically being bathed by this man. And his body servant, which apparently means I need a body servant because that means they bathe you. But they're having a conversation about how do you feel about snails and how do you feel about oysters? Is it unethical or immoral to eat either one? And ultimately he stands up and he's like, because I eat both. And it's like, whoa. And it's very clear what he's saying. It's just he's trying to see if it's okay. You know, even though he's, you know, the emperor or whatever, he's Pharaoh. I don't know. I can't remember Spartacus, But I do remember that scene.
A ruler. Yeah.
He's the ruler.
A ruler of some
sort. He's the king guy. Some other more, again, positive might be strong, but at least neutral. The Color Purple, Alice Walker, includes a beautifully nuanced portrayal of romantic and sexual relationship between two women, which are Celie and Shug. The film adaptation directed by Spielberg keeps the emotional intimacy between the women, though it lessens the explicit nature of their sexual relationships. I think one of them was actually played by Whoopi Goldberg.
Yeah, it was.
We're a woman.
And you can definitely see the depth of the relationship there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cabaret from 1972. Mm-hmm. The character of Brian Roberts, who was played by Michael York, is depicted as having relationships with both men and women, which was a rare but great sort of representation of bisexuality in the early 70s. And I absolutely love that film because there's that scene where Brian and Liza Minnelli's character, I should know it, but I can't think of it, are discussing, you know, their love. And she's like, he was like, screw Max. And she's like, I have. And then he looks at her and there's this long pause. He goes, me too. And it's like this look of shock, right? But it's such a, I love that film. It's a great film.
That's a great scene.
So Fried Green Tomatoes by Fannie Flagg, I guess the full title is Fried Green Tomatoes and the Whistle Stop Cafe. Mm. The novel depicts a close relationship between Iggy and Ruth that is often interpreted as romantic. The 1991 film adaptation tones down the romance, of course, but maintains the strong bond between the women. Mm-hmm. Also thinking of movies like Thelma and Louise, which was Gina Davis and Susan Sarandon, where they kiss at the end. And it's like they clearly love each other. Maybe it's not a sexual love, but it is clearly love.
Yeah.
And this journey in relationship, or this journey that their relationship has gone on, it's really...
It's interesting how much, particularly as you're going through female characters and their relationships, is how frequently it's portrayed to someone who's not looking for it as simply a strong friendship.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
When in actuality, if you're looking for it, then you'll see that not there's actually something more there. There's more intimacy there.
Well, and there's it's funny because there's those like art historian kind of things. Mm. You see tags on these ancient paintings of, you know, Lilith and her housemate. And they're like, they're both laying naked. And like, oh, no, they weren't having sex. They were just really good friends. I'm like,
yeah,
really?
Yeah.
Why? And it goes back to looking at it through the lens that you want to look at it through. So you look at it and you go, well, yeah, of course they can't have sex. They're two women. Mm-hmm. How does sex even work for them? And so they must be really good friends who like to hang out naked in bed and eat grapes. So there's a lot of that, and you know, sort of touching on a bit of that as well, is that so many times, and this is kind of a fun game to play, whenever you see a lesbian or bisexual woman on screen versus a gay or bisexual man on screen, it goes back to the what we talked about at the beginning, which was the laugh at one, be frightened of the other, in that most lesbian women are not attractive.
Yeah.
They are seen as stern or dark or just frumpy, or the men are seen as painted clowns that are unreliable and effeminate. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting to see that. But
that goes into the stereotypes, right?
Yeah. And it is, you know, and the question is, cause you think like Harvey Fierstein, who is this, like, he is like, I think a self-described big ass poof. Like he is effeminate and silly, but so like, is it a, you know, what came first, chicken or the egg kind of thing? Mm-hmm. Do you see that representation and go, oh, that's who I am? Whereas some people see that and go, that is a negative representation of our community. And I think it's kind of interesting to look at it both ways, because both ways can be correct, I think.
Well, it just depends on the person, right? And how they behave and how they identify and how they feel. But it also could be a bit of you grow up seeing these characters. And if you feel like you identify in a similar way to what they're showing, then you take on those traits and you behave like them, right? It's you imitate them as a child or as a young adult.
Yeah, fair enough.
So it's a bit of that circular thing, which not always, but definitely for some.
So lastly, I just want to kind of dive into a couple of films. One is Rope, Alfred Hitchcock, which was a 1948 film. It's based off the play by Patrick Hamilton, which was inspired by the real life murders committed by Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb, Leopold and Loeb, which many people are familiar with. They were two wealthy students at the University of Chicago who in the 1920s kidnapped and murdered 14-year-old Bobby Franks. But it was the crime of the century. Mm. So, but the two real people were believed to be in a homosexual relationship, Leopold and Loeb. The rope characters of Brandon Shaw and Philip Morgan. So the whole gist of it is, if you've never seen the film, it's brilliant. So it's two young men, right when the film starts, they murder a guy and then they put his body basically in a trunk under a dining table and then have this big party. So it's like they immediately kill this guy and they're not doing it for any reason other than that they were like, I wonder if I can get this done. I wonder if I can get away with this kind of thing. It's this very brash thing. But the characters, you can't watch that film and go, oh, they're straight. Like they're so queerly written. Throughout the film, they exhibit this close, intimate relationship. And they even say things like, you know, how did you feel during it? How did you feel after? And it's like, it's not until his body was limp that I felt something, you know,
like exhilaration or something.
Yeah, it's
like that. Yeah.
It's so funny. And like you watch it and the way they're delivering this line. Mm-hmm. And this got through the Hays Code. And it's like it's clear that the people who were running the Hays Code had no idea what they were looking at. They didn't know. They looked at it and went, oh, these are two rich kids.
Unless it's obvious kind of, because I mean I watched that scene and I'm like, they're talking about sex. They're not talking about killing this person.
Yeah. No, it's clearly an analogy for sex.
Yeah.
And then lastly is an odd one. It's Midnight Cowboy, which you might know as the first X-rated film to ever win Best Picture. It is known as a very, very heterosexual film, right? Mm. It's a buddy drama, but it's basically John Voight as Joe Buck, a naive hustler from Texas, hoping to make it big in New York City, and Dustin Hoffman as Rizzo, a gruff but pretty good guy, con man. So it's a buddy movie, right? Mm. Over the film, their bond has suggested, you know, how close they are emotionally has led some people to think that it's queer coding, right? Mm. So they don't ever state that there's a romantic or sexual relationship between John and Rizzo, but the emotional connection is undeniable, which is why I think it's interesting and kind of sad that queer coding is, oh, these two guys are having an emotional relationship. They're clearly gay. Mm-hmm. And I think that sort of is part of the problem as well, in that that's great for the queer community, but I think it's terrible for the non-queer community.
That you can't be emotional, have emotions, and be straight.
Yeah. And like that's part of our problem as a whole, is that we should be able to see two men together and go, oh yeah, of course they can love each other, and it not have to do with their genitalia.
Or show affection.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it's just, it's an interesting thing to take that interpretive layer and add the homoerotic overtones, I don't know, to it, only because of their emotional connection. Right. But if you were a queer kid in the early 70s, I think that movie came out in the early 70s or late 60s, that would be great to see that and go, oh, cool, how I feel is okay. But it would be nice if straight kids could have done that too.
Yeah.
I think that we would have been out of, we could have had less problems than we already do. Just for anyone out there who's curious to watch Celluloid Closet, we found it on YouTube. Yeah. It was just on YouTube. It's about an hour and 40 minutes long.
Yeah. Apparently at times past it's been on different streaming services and things, but at the moment, we found it on YouTube. It was actually a really good watch. So if you get a chance, look it up, have a watch.
It was free to watch.
Yeah. It's called, it's The Celluloid Closet. Yeah. So check it out.
So that's queer coding, or at least our interpretation of queer coding.
A skin deep kind of like,
I mean, we didn't even scratch the surface. Yeah.
Surface level.
We are looking at a postage stamp from space, basically.
Yeah. Because there's so much to it. And it's been such a part of history and of media and so many examples of it. And it's just really interesting to see how that has influenced people in their lives, but then also how perceptions of the queer community by the heterosexual community has worked its way into the media, and just all of it, the interconnectedness of it is just really fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I enjoy it. It's it's interesting because, you know, thinking like basic instinct, I know she's meant to be bisexual in that, and she is clearly bad. But like there's, I think about the films that I grew up with and trying to attach myself to a character. And yeah, I guess it is. It's interesting. And maybe that's why I went to horror, is that I always liked the bad guy, right? Maybe that's why. Maybe I didn't even realize what I was doing. And starting out watching Jafar and LeFou and those, and then going, well, the next logical step is Jason Voorhees and Freddy Krueger.
Right. That's a big jump.
I mean
you skipped a few steps there, babe.
Maybe one or two. But it is. Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Cool. Let us know what you think. We love to hear about it. Join us on our Discord chat. You can support us at any level on patreon.com/bythebypodcast, and you will get an invite to our Discord community. We love that group. In fact, that's where the McGavo came from, is from our Discord community. Or you can email us theatomsoflove@gmail.com. Message us on any of our socials. We are at By the By Podcast on Facebook, on Twitter, and on Instagram. Come join us for the pendulum party. Looking forward to that. That's going to be fun.
Yeah, just a few weeks away.
Exciting. Check us out on our website. You can get links to where you can find tickets for the pendulum party, www.bythebye.com.au. Mm-hmm. And go to the where are we at? Where are we at? Events. Where are we at? Events. That's where we at. Yeah. So anything else you'd like to say?
Nah.
We will see you next week.
Bye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.